Have you ever been to a family event and you've been sitting down on the ground with your child who's crying under the table, and a relative wonders out loud why you're not just being tougher? Maybe you're trying to explain ADHD to a teacher, or maybe your partner just thinks it's all screen time and doesn't even believe in ADHD. Enter A Child's Diagnosis, A Mum's Guide to Support and Helping Others Get It. Now, this guide is here to save you from those endless justifications and give you a break from being the ADHD explainer in every room that you enter. Here's what's inside. How to talk to professionals, because forgetting all of your points and remembering them in the shower later isn't really the vibe that you need in an appointment. How to handle skeptical relatives, being armed with responses that are factual, firm, and just the right amount of smile and nod. Support for your child, because navigating a world built for neurotypicals and Uncle Bob's back in the day speech really just doesn't help. And also practical strategies for school and home that work in real life. This guide isn't just about managing a diagnosis, it's about making sure your child feels seen, supported, and unconditionally loved, whilst you stay calm, or at least look like you're calm. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au. It's far less awkward than telling your mother-in-law to stop calling ADHD a phase. All right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have a very exciting guest from my end, because everyone knows I'm an absolute nerd. We have Sue Larkey. How are you, Sue?
I'm fantastic. Thank you, Jane, for having me on the podcast.
So in ADHD Mums, we talk always about the connection between the parent and the teacher, which is why I have Sue Larkey here. Sue Larkey, if you haven't heard of her, she's mainly within the educator space. She has a lot of practical experience in teaching. So she's got a master's in special ed. She's also done her doctorate in education. She's got a huge 1.3 million downloads. I nearly said $1 million. And I was like, I don't do that.
Well, podcast. Bring it in. Send it my way, Jane. I would love that. If you could organize that, it'd be a lovely gift. Thank you.
Could you imagine if you got paid $1 a download? You would have a lot of money.
No, I am not Taylor Swift, baby.
Oh, if only. Sue has authored a lot of books on autism. She's got a lot of experience, and she is really working within that professional development space for educators and teachers who are crying out for help. So welcome to you, Sue.
Thank you so much. And look, Jane, what I love about us talking today is that I'm going to get to talk to your parents. But interestingly, nearly all my books I have co-authored with a parent, because I believe when a parent and a teacher works together, we come out with our best resources. And you know, there's no point me saying to a parent, well, just do this at home. And they go, well, that doesn't work at home. But there's no point a teacher saying to me, just do this in the classroom. And I'm like, well, I've got 32 kids. It doesn't work here. I'm all about the stuff that works for both of us. And I think, Jane, that's where you and I are so similar in how we believe finding that sort of sandwich where we can work together and be realistic and support each other. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, because I mean, teachers are obviously the professionals in teaching, as are PEDs the professionals in medicating and assessing. But the parent is the expert in their own child. So if you put those two brains together, you are going to get a really good result. And I think if the parents and the teachers can work together, everyone is happier. But when you get on that mismatch, and sorry, I'm going off the topic, it can be really tricky.
No, 100%, 100%. And that's why Anna Tallemans, who I've written a lot of books with, she's like written a book on how to work with teachers, because what she found with her son, Daniel, it was in her best interest to have a good relationship with the teacher. But if parents are listening and going, oh, Sue, I'm having trouble with the teacher, here's my next advice. Build a good relationship with someone in the leadership team, because they're the one who's going to place your child the next year. So if you have a bad year, work on next year. And most leadership teams don't turn over. They're normally in the school for 10 years or more. So get to build that relationship, because what I've found, often then I'll get a good teacher assistant suddenly come into the room, even though they can't swap teachers. So parents, just keep that on the down low, but I highly recommend that you have someone in the leadership or the learning support space who are your advocate, because if you've got a bad teacher, you've got a cheerleader in the school.
Oh, that is a great point. I had a tricky situation at one of the schools we were at. And you made a great point, because the turning point for me was when I started to point out the positive things that someone in the leadership team had been doing. And suddenly there was changes that were happening, and it was kind of like I built a relationship with him and it just went around. It's a really great point you've made, actually.
Yeah. If parents are here listening going, I want to change schools, I want to change, I always say don't go in and look at the year group your child is in. Look at year 5 and 6s or look at year 11 and 12s because schools are very good at making that lovely presentation to when families come in, but that's not what you want to see. And you want to know, like, what are the leadership team like? Because, like, get to know the principal, assistant principal, because they often end up being the principal. I get to build those relationships. I think they can be so much more valuable. The other thing is just, I think we sometimes forget it has to be 4 positives to 1 negative, whether it's a parent working with a teacher or vice versa. We need to give 4 positives to 1 negative. So really remembering that you've got to say quite a few positives to a teacher before it sinks in that you're on their side. So, you know, if you want to give a negative, you've got to wrap it up in a lot of good stuff. And that's what Anna used to say with Daniel. She'd have to go to school and go, like, I really like this, this, and this, and this that's happening. And I'm so happy about that. But I'm just wondering about this. So don't come in with the guns blazing. Come in with the positives that are already you've noticed.
That is a really good point. I also think it's very similar with partners. Mm-hmm. So you have a team member, an adult in your family. And we obviously, we're not talking about DV or anything like that. We're talking about an able-bodied adult that is in your home. If you can engage that team member, you will have a better time. And it can be tricky. And it is a little bit like 4 positives to 1 negative. It can feel a little forced, but you are going to be better off. So sometimes it's a bit of like, suck it is what I have to do.
Actually, Jane, on that, having worked with thousands of families, what I would say is this too. Remember, not every strategy works for everybody. So don't criticize. If your partner's not doing something exactly the way you think it should be done, look at the outcome. Is it working for your child? It doesn't always have to work for you. It has to work for the child. So, for example, I think us mums, and I'm very guilty of it, I have 3 neurotypical children, but I know I'm a micromanager. I'm about, have you got your bus pass? Have you done this? Andrew was our primary parent at home because I was off traveling, helping schools and families. He would just be like, okay, it's Wednesday, off we go. And I'd be like, what about violin? What about the... What's interesting? It worked for him. So why do I should micromanage him? No one wants to be that. And the truth is, I've seen this week with kids that they respond better to one parent or another, but you jumping in doesn't help build that relationship. They've got to work it out. Does that make sense?
No, it does. And, you know, if we bring it back to executive function too, if you're continuing to do some of those things for them, maybe you're not giving them the chance to also develop. So whilst we go back onto executive function, let's not go over to what it is.
Well, actually, Jane, I hate to say it, we haven't even brought up executive functioning. So anyone who's listening, Jane and I, we're going to talk about executive functioning and we have just jumped into a whole lot of building relationships. But the truth is, none of your executive functioning strategies will work unless you build a relationship with the child. I mean, you can have the best program, you can be the best parent, done every parenting course, but if you haven't built rapport with a child, none of my strategies work. It's all about relationships. It's the number one thing. And I think parents will know that. And I'll be honest, I've had it where teachers have these beautiful glossy programs, beautiful IEP, but they don't get along with your child. It's not going to work. So we can talk about executive functioning as much as we want, but until we build good relationships, so that's why I'm glad we started with that. But we'll jump into executive functioning now.
I feel like I should do an episode at some point about like basic communication for autistic and ADHD people to build the relationship. Because, you know, we're talking about the 4 positives to 1 negative and autistic people, me included, like I have to force the 4 things out because I just want to get to the point.
Yes.
But it can come off quite like cutting, but it's all not meant that way.
No.
But it is coming across that way. It's a really great point around connection.
Well, but actually, Jane, I worked in an autism school, so I had a high percentage of parents who were diagnosed and undiagnosed. And I remember once writing to one of my dads, his very specific list, because he would send with his daughter literally a backpack full of so much stuff because he wanted to be a good dad, that perfectionism. And literally, it would be a 40-degree day and she'd have gumboots in her backpack. So I actually had to write a very specific list. And I'll be honest, I felt so rude sending him this message going, this is what you send in term one. This is what you send in term two. If it rains, we don't go outside. We don't need gumboots. I was that clear. And he came back with the most, thank you so much. And I, to this day, I can see, like, for him, he was trying so hard to be a good parent that he was overcompensating. And when I felt like I'd written this really rude email, including the times he was allowed to contact me because he was contacting me 24 hours a day, he was relieved. And I was like, oh, it's just like his daughter. He needs routine, structure, clear boundaries. And she was the same. She relaxed when I gave her that. That's what built the relationship. But I thought I was going to blow the relationship.
So he probably thought, oh, that's just like 10% of what I was doing.
Yeah.
Look at all this free time I have. No, I'm not doing it.
Because he would send like a lunchbox and then an emergency lunchbox, or he'd send a drink bottle, but what if she didn't want to drink that today? Like, can you imagine the anxiety he was putting in every morning to doing all this for his beautiful daughter? And when I sort of gave him permission not to do any of that and told him, I have stuff at school. If she doesn't like her food, I've always got extra stuff here. I know she likes these barbecue shapes. Gave him permission not to worry. Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, anyway, I love it how they say autistic people don't have empathy. And I'm like, oh my God, that's
only made it right. For him, that was an executive functioning problem, without a doubt. Like the planning, prioritizing and organizing, what he had become is an over-organizer, over-planner, over-what-if, like the anxiety around that. And this is why I think executive functioning is the one thing I wished I learned about at uni, and I wish they had on more assessments. Like families who are listening, go back and look at your child's assessment. Did they look at their executive functioning skills? Because that is the one thing you actually can work on. And my favorite philosopher is Bob the Builder. Do you remember what Bob the Builder said?
Oh, I love Bob the Builder.
Bob the Builder says, can we fix? Yes, we can. Executive functioning is one of the things we can fix more than a lot of the other things that are challenging to fix. You know, I mean, I say embrace difference to make a difference. So I say embrace our children's way of learning and engaging. But executive functioning, helping them with planning, prioritizing, organizing, we absolutely can fix that and put in place things to help them, you know, and support their executive functioning. Just like I say, I go to the gym. I don't just work on my abs. I have to work on all my muscles. Well, with executive functioning, you've got to work on all the areas of executive functioning and you have to keep practicing it. Me going to the gym once, I'm not going to be running a marathon, promise you.
Okay. Well, in the spirit of the lack of time, because we have gone off topic as well with that 20 time frame that we've done, which you went with me, so I'm gonna blame you because you're apparently neurotypical.
Totally.
And you came with me.
Okay.
What about this question? What do you think are some common mistakes parents make that they could do differently if they knew differently?
Let's take something like emotional control or emotional regulation. That is part of executive functioning. What a lot of families do, because they might have read other parenting books or positive parenting, like my friend Anna and parent, failed 3 positive parenting courses because her son needed parenting differently, right? Now, one of the things with emotional regulation is teaching your child how you problem solve through things and talking out loud. Oh, I went to the fridge to make a cup of coffee. There was no milk there. Now I can't have coffee. What's my plan B? What else could I have? And my kids respond really well to the language plan B, plan C. One of my little boys said to me, it's lucky there's 26 letters in the alphabet, Mrs. Lucky, because we can have a plan C, D, E, F. Fantastic, right? But often what we don't do, we don't talk through our own thinking and emotions. And I think we need to normalize our emotions. Like, you know what? I say to my kids, oh, I went out for a coffee with a girlfriend on the weekend and she was running really late and I got really anxious. And then I text her and she's like, oh, I'm not coming anymore. And I was disappointed and sad. And I just sort of wondered, is she going to be my friend anymore? When is the last time you said that out loud? When is the last time you said that to your child? And I have found over the years as a teacher, if I say that stuff, it actually does build a relationship with this child because I'm saying I get upset too. I get let down. I have friendships I'm questioning and it normalizes it. Whereas a lot of children with ADHD and autism, their superpower is catastrophizing. If a friend doesn't turn up or is away, they think they're never coming back. It's the end of the world, you know? So teaching children to understand their own emotions, I think they learn it through us. But we are so good at not talking emotions out loud. So I think parents should talk their emotions out loud. And, you know, when your child maybe has ADHD paralysis or time blindness, actually going, you know what? We are running late. So what is our plan B? What are we going to do? We're 10 minutes late now. Getting your child to say, okay, well, that means I'm going to miss out on this. Well, that means we're going to have to go faster. Let the child work out what we need to do instead of you running around like, where are your runners? Where's this? Where's that? Because then they're going to pick up on your anxiety and it's probably going to hit for a meltdown. So actually, in that moment, as hard as it may feel, going, okay, we're running 10 minutes late. What could we do? And that is the muscle at the gym. My trainer doesn't just stand there training himself. He gets me to do the exercises. So what are the exercises your child needs? Is it them keeping a better eye on the time or putting on their own timer? Is it them working out when things go wrong, what to do? Is it when they're feeling angry, actually saying to you, I need 5 minutes, rather than you telling them they need 5 minutes? Does that make sense? Like training, and I know I don't like the word training, but I'm just using that as an analogy of like training them to use their executive functioning muscles by being their coach, you know, and being their trainer.
Oh, I agree. And I think there's some camaraderie in that too. You know, I think it was a big change for us as a family when I started to admit that I would walk into a room and not know where I was. Like, came in here for something. I just have no idea what it is. And normalizing that, or, you know, going out somewhere, as you said, be like, we're running late. I'm just going to go out and do the washing, go, but this is how time blindness works. Mm-hmm. Someone come get me in 2 minutes because I'm 100% going to go to the bins.
Yes.
And yes. Making it more funny. I like a good bit of humor.
I love humor too. And I think if you can change the diagnostic criteria, I would love to change it. If I change the diagnostic criteria, I would have executive functioning as one of the main things we look at. Because for anyone who doesn't know, executive functioning is everything from impulse control, your child interrupting you or calling out in class. There's no point telling a child not to call out. You need to give them strategies. So for me, that might be giving the child a sensory tool to hold so that it helps them regulate and wait. You know, you've got your impulse control, you've got your emotional regulation, planning and prioritizing. So what you're saying is you go out to the washing and you get distracted, right? And people see distraction. What they don't realize is that little bit of impulse control plus your planning, yes, you know, and then the organization. And for parents who have a children with ADHD, they know what sort of day their child's had by just looking at their backpack. I always say that everything falling out of the backpack, this isn't a good day, yes? Everything neatly arranged, probably a better day. But if your child's walking to the car and there's litter coming behind, this just shows they've had a really bad day and this isn't the day to ask, how was your day? That's what I would say, yeah? And then that task initiation, which I think we don't talk enough about, and in my new ADHD executive functioning course, Dean Beadle, who has ADHD and autism, talks about, I'd heard of ADHD paralysis, but he talks about autistic inertia, which is the getting stuck. So he will get out of bed. He'll know he's got something good coming up, you know, doing something he loves. He loves Doctor Who. So he'll know he's going to do, but he gets stuck in the getting dressed and what to wear to that Doctor Who convention. Like he had complete paralysis, what to do in that moment. And I had never heard of autistic inertia. I had seen it, but I get the planning and prioritizing can also end up in this paralysis, the overwhelm, even if the child has something they're looking forward to, which explains why for some children, you can offer them the best reward in the world and they still can't do the task to get there.
Yeah, I just came back from Sydney and I had the suitcase there. I put it on Instagram. I should have left. And that was when I attempted to pack it. And then I got so late and nearly missed. I had to cry for them to let me on. And I sat down and thought, why do I just get so overwhelmed with what I'm going to wear at a conference that I just blow up my whole day? And it's a great way of putting it, the autistic inertia, because it's just paralyzing when it happens to you.
Absolutely. But the worst thing we can do then is push the child or get angry with them. What we have to then do, and in this situation, it's like me when I've hurt my back at the gym, my trainer's not going to be working on that. What he's going to do is support me. So knowing when your child, what Temple Grandin's mum calls the loving push, when do they need support and when do they need the loving push? Now, in that situation, you had paralysis over what to wear. Same as Dean. It's the choice making. So you might say to your child, okay, we're going to wear our runners today. Or you might have a child who needs maybe oppositional defiant or PDA. And you might go, do you want to wear your red runners or your blue runners? Not a wardrobe full of runners. Does that make sense? So actually,
yes. Back.
Which actually reminds me, I would love parents listening to one of the key things I have found for children who are highly anxious about school is teaching them to lay their clothes out the night before. Because often in the morning, your anxiety is high, your problem solving's low. So you're more likely to get that ADHD paralysis, autistic inertia in the morning. Because when a child wakes up, there's a lot of hurry up. And the word hurry up can trigger a meltdown. So I'd love parents to think, what are the planning and prioritizing you can teach your child to do the night before? But when they're younger, you might have to help them lay out their shoes and socks and put them. By the time they're 15, I'm hoping before they go to bed the night before, they lay that out, right? So you're putting in place those processes. We're building independence by putting in place those schedules or timetables. But it's often things like that, like looking at your family. What are the triggers? Is your kid really going to wake up in the morning and read their book? Why don't we put their reader straight in their bag? Are they really going to email that assessment task in the morning? How about we put the assessment task in the bag? So actually creating those routines and repetition around things actually stops a lot of that paralysis, because it's what you talked about, going to a conference out of routine.
It's a great point though, because when we look at the load on the mum, and we've got ADHD mums rampant on this in this audience. So when we're talking about, if you're the one who has to prompt, right, it's fucking exhausting.
Yes.
But what you're talking about is upskilling them in those moments. So then you can start to give them more of the jobs. So you're not holding them all. Because if you've got three kids and we're doing all of the whole, you know, put your clothes out the night before till they're 15. Oh my God, that's a long time.
No. And remember, routines and repetition is like me at the gym. So the planning and organizing. So what I'd say to my child is, okay, like I had a mum of a three-year-old who said to me, I always lay out his clothes. I'm like, no. He needs to do it. The kinesthetic laying it out. See, I think for ADHD kids, the kinesthetic learning, we've moved away from that. The physical doing something helps with your planning and prioritizing and your working memory. So get your child to lay out what they think. And then you come and go, hey, something's missing. Let's have a look. What's missing? Don't tell them it's the socks missing. Don't tell them what's missing. Oh, your hat. Okay, let's go and look for the hat. Like, so actually letting the child look what's wrong. And I wouldn't use the word wrong, but I'd be like, oh, what's missing? You know, and using a bit of humor. Well, how's that going to work? What can you see? And I think the children actually then get better at problem solving and processing and working it out. Because what they'll do is they'll hit the panic button when the socks aren't there or the hat isn't there. So you're actually giving them those skills and you're going to free yourself up. A bit like with homework, Anna and I in our book, The Ultimate Guide to School and Home, with her son, Daniel. Daniel, I think today would get a PDA diagnosis. I don't know if you've talked about PDA on your podcast. Yeah.
Yes.
So, but he got like an ODD because that's sort of what we called it then, opposition to fire. But Anna could never say to him, what time are you doing your homework? Because he'd go later. So she would say, are you going to do your homework at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock? Right. So he had a choice and that choice was very important to Daniel. So he could say 4 o'clock. Okay. So Anna would be right. But what she ensured at home, he didn't have to get organized. He's had a long day at school. He's exhausted. So she would make sure at 4 o'clock, drinks there, snacks there, timers there, no distractions, things laid out. His one used to be, oh, the dog needs feeding. Oh, you know, oh, there's something like he would be, you know, when you put your toddler to bed and they're like, oh, one more wee or one more drink. You know, he'd be like that to sit down to do his assessments. It is in secondary. And so she would be like, she'd sit him down and then she'd go, okay, let's just look. Is there anything on our mind? You know, is there anything that you're worried about? And what she used to do, she'd write a list. Oh, feed the dog. Good. We'll do that when we're finished. Because what she found as soon as he got up is like a toddler, then he had to reset him.
Oh, of course. But then if you don't write it down, you know that you're going to forget. So you've got to do it in the moment. So write it down. It's a great point.
And that also brings me to something else that I've only learned about in the last year. Jane, I wish I'd known about it because it makes sense. Object permanence. So we
I love that.
Permanence in children where something's hidden and then they don't know it exists. Many of your parents will be frustrated because your kid has piles everywhere, piles, piles. But if you touch them, they'll be really frustrated because it's an organized mess. That's what I call it. An organized mess versus a mess is completely different. But what it is, and many adults have told me this, that if you put things away, then they're worried they're going to forget about it because of the working memory. So many of my children need stuff. If teachers put stuff away in a tote box, my child's going to be anxious because what if I forget where it is? What if I forget to go back to it? So it's a type of object permanence, and that it's another thing for them to store in their memory, and then they're going to be anxious. They're going to forget about it. So there's nothing wrong with having piles, but what I would recommend is you can get them at Target, a lovely clear tub where they can see what's in there. And I love post-it notes. Teach your children to use post-it notes, because if something's piled up, then you get anxious. But if there's a post-it note and you've got an arrow or a star, then all you're looking at is the little post-it notes. So they don't all need to be laid out everywhere for the kids. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. I'm just thinking of my daughter who uses her double bed as her piles. So she puts her piles and then she sleeps on a mattress next to it so she doesn't upset the piles because she knows where things are. And when I first saw it, I thought, oh my God, it's a visual representation of but she was loses it if I touch them. So I just give up. Yeah. Like, fine, that's fine.
No. Choose piles. Your battles. Choose your battles. It's the most important thing. It really is. And I think for families listening, you've got to ask, like, what is my battle? I'm going to battle for my child to find their clothes in the morning, or I'm going to teach them to put them out the night before. Am I going to battle with all those piles, or no, it's an organized mess, and maybe have a system that, you know, I love the phone because you can take a photo, you know, that if we are having visitors and I want that stuff packed away, we'll take a photo of the piles, we'll put our post-it notes so you know that nothing's going to get muddled up, and put it in a clear box, then that can make a difference. That's how I see it.
I agree. We're going to finish up, Sue, because I know we've gone over time. I know you've got some courses on executive function. If anyone wants to know more, where do they find them?
Yep. So if they just go to Sue Larkey, and it's larkey.com.au, there's lots of courses on there. And I have lots and lots of parents do my courses. I know when you go to my website, it looks very teacher focused, but it's that whole thing we need to work together. And I have parents do my courses all the time. In fact, I've got a lot of parents upcoming on my podcast sharing their successes. So hopefully they can join me there too.
Excellent. Okay. Well, probably no one's got the working memory to remember it, so I will put it into the show notes. No one needs to freak out.
I love it.
Thank you so much for your time, Sue. I really appreciated it.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.